listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Battling Bartitsu Babes. I remember reading a Sherlock Holmes story as a young man in the 70s, in which the brilliant detective makes use of a fighting style that he called Baritsu during a fight with his evil nemesis, Professor Moriarty. As you might imagine, this really piqued my interest. I remember thinking, what the hell is Baritsu? Is it even a real martial art? This was in the days before the internet, so my research skills and resources for information weren't sufficient for finding the answer to these questions. But now I do know, and as is often the case, research reveals much more information than you might have thought. As it turns out, there never was a martial art called Baritsu, but there was one called Bartitsu. You see, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories, simply got the spelling wrong. The story of this martial art starts in late Victorian England with an engineer named Edward William Barton Wright. While working in Japan during the 4 years from 1895 through 1898, Barton Wright trained in Shinden Fudo Ryu Jiu-Jitsu and in Kodokan Judo, which was less than 2 decades old at the time. He almost surely met and even possibly trained under the founder of Judo, Jigoro Kano. Upon returning to England, Barton Wright began teaching his own combination of these two martial arts and dubbed his new curriculum Bartitsu. Over the next 2 years, he also trained in boxing, wrestling, French savate, and a variation of the stick fighting art called Lacan, a variation developed by a Swiss man named Pierre Vigny. Barton Wright expanded the curriculum of Bartitsu with techniques and concepts from these Western martial arts. He opened the Bartitsu School of Arms and Physical Culture in London in 1900. The school offered classes in self-defense, various martial sports, and a comprehensive exercise program for keeping the students' fitness level at its peak. The business also offered physical therapy services. The Bartitsu School became quite popular and was frequented by many members of London's high society. Barton Wright's contributions to the martial arts were actually quite similar to those of Bruce Lee, in concept if not in scope, but happened 70 years earlier. Some of the parallels between them are eerily surprising. Barton Wright drew from a variety of cultures, combining Eastern and Western martial arts techniques, almost a century before Bruce Lee was criticized for doing the same thing. He thought of combat as taking place in different ranges, and drew from the arts that he thought performed best for each range, just as Bruce Lee would do in the future. Also like Mr. Lee, in addition to his passion for the fighting arts, Barton Wright was a devoted fitness enthusiast, a real mad scientist of physical culture, and a dedicated gym rat. One of his top students was a woman named Edith Margaret Garrod, who went on to become perhaps the first woman to teach the martial arts professionally in modern times. Ms. Garrod was a mere 4 feet 11 inches tall. She could throw a man more than twice her size to the ground with style and panache. She also became an important figure in the suffragette movement. You see, even at the beginning of the 20th century, women throughout most of the world were forbidden to hold public office, vote, own property, or even ask for a divorce. You know, man stuff. At least man stuff in the mind of the powers that were at the time. One of the greatest of these powers was the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. It wouldn't be until the 1920s that it would become the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Folks on the side of the British political spectrum that favored passing laws that would grant these rights to women formed organizations that petitioned the government to change the law. And when this failed, they organized public protests. Over the years, many of these people became disgusted with the recalcitrance of the government and the lack of progress towards women's suffrage, despite their many efforts. Some of them ramped up the activism, engaging in acts of civil disobedience and vandalism. These activists were known as suffragettes. The government and vigilantes on the opposite political side ramped up the intensity of their response to these actions as well. This all came to a head on a day that would come to be known as Black Friday, November 18, 1910. On that day, a group of 300 suffragettes approached the Parliament building in order to stage a protest. A much larger group of anti-suffrage vigilantes and club-wielding policemen attacked the women, seriously injuring many of them. Two of the women died of their injuries. In addition to these horrible facts, after the event, many, if not most of the women, told reporters that they had also been groped by their attackers during the melee. Ah, democracy. Another common police practice was to drag many of the freshly clubbed suffragettes to jail, where they were held for extended periods in squalid conditions, with little regard for due process. One counter tactic used by the jailed women was to engage in hunger strikes in order to curry popular support. The prison authorities responded by force-feeding some of them. This entailed a prison doctor overseeing the process of guards forcing the woman's mouth open with sharp-edged steel gags that often broke and damaged the prisoner's teeth and gums before shoving 4-foot-long rubber hoses down their throats and into their esophagus. This usually led to uncontrollable fits of gagging and vomiting, which the prison doctor usually ignored, until the entire contents of the liquid were forced down the poor unfortunate woman's throat. The government also passed a law referred to as the Cat and Mouse Act, which allowed them to release hunger strikers from prison until they had regained their health, and then re-arrest them and imprison them. Edith Garrod, our aforementioned martial arts instructor, being both a woman and a self-realized badass, was enraged at these and other abuses being inflicted on members of the suffragette movement. She did more than merely join the movement, though. She trained any and all suffragettes she could in the womanly art of self-defense. She also recruited the 30 best students from the bunch to form a bodyguard unit for famed suffragette leader, Emmeline Pankhurst, who had herself already been beaten, arrested, and abused in prison. This bodyguard was also known as the Jujit Suffragettes and the Amazons. Ms. Pankhurst and the Amazons took up the practice of wearing 3 inches of cardboard as armor under their dresses when they journeyed forth to protest. They also carried Indian clubs under their skirts as well. They were not going to passively accept beatings or gropings from vigilantes or the authorities, or allow Ms. Pankhurst to be attacked if they could prevent it. This involved not only using their martial skills, it also included using deception. They employed concealed barbed wire, disguises, and decoy body doubles to aid in getting Ms. Pankhurst safely away in case of trouble. There's some history you probably never learned in school. When World War I broke out in 1914, the women's suffrage movement displayed admirable patriotism when it unilaterally halted its activities. Pankhurst and her colleagues instead used their political influence to help the war effort against the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, and the Turks. At war's end in 1918, the British government finally passed a law giving the vote to women who were over 30. Specifying this peculiar age was done to ensure that women would not constitute a majority of voters, since a large fraction of the men of Britain had been killed in the war. Emmeline Pankhurst died in 1928, mere weeks before the voting age for women was finally reduced to 21. After women gained the right to vote in Great Britain, Edith Garrod went back to her life as a martial arts instructor. She eventually even trained police officers in self-defense. She died in 1971 at the ripe old age of 99. Edward William Barton Wright closed the Bartitsu School in 1903, choosing to give more attention to the physical therapy side of the business, although there is evidence that he continued teaching Bartitsu in private sessions and continued refining the curriculum. He died in 1951 at the ripe old age of 90. I love discovering stories like this of how the history of the martial arts interacts with the rest of history. I hope you enjoyed hearing it. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, or check out old episodes of the Martial Brain Podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Marshall Brain. The Marshall Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Marshall Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.